Kentucky Psychologist, a podcast brought to you by the Kentucky Psychological Association. The Kentucky Psychologist will get into the minds of top psychologists from Kentucky and occasionally friends from across the country. We'll talk about what leading mental health experts are interested in and excited about. Hear about all the ways psychologists in clinical practice, research, leadership, and applied settings are doing to improve and save lives. All right. Thank you all for joining us on this episode of the Kentucky Psychologist. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Sarah Nolan, who is our master's representative for KPA. Sarah, do you want to go ahead and just give us a quick intro about what you do in your professional setting and also what you do for KPA?
Sure. So again, my name is Sarah Nolan. I am a licensed psychological practitioner in the state of Kentucky, and I'm currently working at True North Counseling and Development in Lexington. Just professionally, what I'm doing with True North is I'm serving as a therapist, and I just started in July, so my books are open, so send me referrals. But my main specialties are providing individual therapy, both in person and virtually, to adults 18 and up. My main specialties are EMDR, interpersonal violence trauma, working through shame and other difficult emotions, and really just helping others discover an authentic self. All too often, I've just encountered clients who've had to hide themselves for whatever reason. And so I've really just put a focus on my career on helping others not be ashamed of who they are and whatever ways that may be. And so I joined KPA in 2011. And so for the 2021 to 2023 term, I am serving as the master's representative. And so my main responsibilities just include meeting with the constituents who are master's licensees or they're just master's degree holders and just bringing their concerns to KPA. And more recently, our focus has been advocating for master's licensure in the state of Kentucky. We're noticing trends where other mental health disciplines are just getting a lot of traction and a lot of attention, a lot more job opportunities. And so we just don't want our master's of psychology license holders to be, you know, put to the wayside. So that's kind of what we're working on now.
That's really awesome. I'm glad your books are open. I'm sure we will get a lot of calls and referrals coming your way here soon. And also, yeah, I had interviewed Don Rogers earlier and he was working with APA on the master's alignment as well. So it'll be interesting to have his podcast come out and then yours as well talking about these issues. So I'm very excited about this. Can you tell us why you wanted to get involved with KPA? Like, what was the spark that brought you here?
Well, full transparency, I think initially it was the encouragement of the graduate professors at Murray State. They're like, okay, you're a colleague now, so go join all the state and governmental organizations that you could. So it's like, okay, I'm doing this because it was encouraged of me to do so. So I did. And so I just kind of maintained membership for the longest time, occasionally would do like a home study or two. But then it was in more recent years where when I noticed I got nominated to the board, and started learning a lot more in depth about what KPA does, I'm like, oh, wow, there are so many things about KPA and what the board does to our professionals in the community. And so I've really liked KPA's passion for, of course, continuing education opportunities and providing critical resources to other professionals. Like, I had no idea, like, if you're starting your private practice, KPA can help steer you towards resources on how to navigate billing and insurance and just all these different nuances that I had no idea about. So that's kind of how I got involved, and now more recently joining as a board of director. And I'm hoping to continue that because I've really loved it.
We love having you here. So please stay with us. Yes. And if you all didn't know, we do provide all those resources. So if you're listening and you don't know anything, go ahead and join us and we can help you get set in your private practice. Just quickly, what made you decide that you wanted to pursue psychology?
Okay. Well, interestingly, psychology was not my first choice when I went to get my undergraduate degree. You know, I grew up in the era of CSIs, right? The crime shows. I was like, ooh, look at these Penelope Garcias, look at these folks working in the crime lab, trying to fight criminals. And it's like, ooh, I really like DNA and I really love genetics. So I originally thought that I would get my graduate degrees in biology and chemistry and do focus on genetics, was what I originally thought. But then sophomore year in the fall semester at Georgetown College, where I went for my undergrad, I noticed that the passion for the sciences had just started dwindling. Grades were slipping, a lot of things were happening, and it's just like, you know, this is just not calling to me anymore as much as I originally had in you know, my senior year of high school. So then what I decided to do, you know, I had, you know, general psychology as a general education requirement. And I talked with the professor, her name is Dr. Susan Bell. And I was like, I don't know what to do because I went in thinking, I was like, oh, yay, biology, yay, chemistry. And then I was clueless. I was like, I don't know what I want to do. And I don't want to delay it too much longer because, you know, I want to graduate on time. So she said, well, how about you take another psychology course? You seem to really like general psychology. So why don't you take social psychology in the spring? See if you like it. If you love it, then hey, maybe psychology is your new, you know, venture. And if not, no worries, right? So it's like, okay. So I took social psychology with Dr. Karen McKenzie and I fell in love. And I was like, this is it. This is it. I love understanding how people work. I love, you know, both internally and externally. So I loved the clinical and social psychology aspects of it. But then after taking some clinical classes with Dr. Jennifer Price and Dr. Jay Castaneda, then I'm like, oh, this is it. This is what I want to do. So then I said, you know what? Okay, I want to be a therapist and help people. So then I said, you know, let's go for it. And I went and got my master's at Murray State University in clinical psychology and got licensed ever since. So it didn't come naturally, but I think everything worked out in the end because I'm in a career that I love.
Yeah. What a unique, you know, way of going in it. And I will say, like, every person we've interviewed has not gone in pursuing the psychology as their degree. Like, no one has, it's always been a completely different path. So this is very interesting to see that no one's quite done that. And how many other avenues, like, everyone's gone down just to find this path. What are some challenges you faced in your career, and then how did you overcome them?
Okay. This one took me a little bit to think about. And so when I thought about, you know, and we all go through challenges, right? Like, everyone has ups and downs. And I said, you know, what would be a unique challenge to me that I guess would make a good story, you know, for resiliency. And so what I kind of picked was, I have always struggled with building an internal sense of competence. I think I kind of always put myself on other people's standard of measurement. So I never really got the sense of who is Sarah or how will Sarah succeed or what will be Sarah's trajectory. It was just do this because other people tell you to do it, or do this because this is what we want for you. So to feel confident in, again, who I was and what I wanted, because again, when I changed my major from biology to psychology, that caused some family uproar. Like, oh my gosh, you won't get a job in psychology. This was catastrophe. And it's like, I just, you know, yeah, that was my first sign of like, trust the process. Major in psychology. Yes, there are a lot of unknowns, but this is the right field. So then master's degree happens, initial licensure happens, initial jobs happen. And even still, there was still this like undercurrent of like, oh, like whether it was imposter syndrome or never take ownership or credit for what you're doing. So then I just kind of carried that with me forever. It's just, you know, because anytime they're like, oh, Sarah, what do you think about this client? What do you think about this diagnosis? What are your perspectives? I'd be like, don't look at me. Don't look at me, right? Look at these other people. They're the experts. They've been in the field forever. And it's like, why not own my own competencies and my own skills and my own talents. So that was probably my biggest unique challenge, was trying to develop what that was. So in 2017, I had changed jobs from community mental health to a designated rape crisis center. And the team of therapists there, you know, again, they kind of, in a figurative way of speaking, kind of bashed it over the head of, we chose you. We interviewed a million other therapists. All of them were skilled and talented, and yet we picked you because of what you brought to the table. And I was like, oh, snap, what are these unique things about me that I can't put a name on? So 2017 to 2019 really put that fire in me to kind of figure out, what is that? What are these things that I'm now going to decide on my own? This is Sarah. This is how I practice. This is my skills, my competencies, my talents, what I can bring to the table. And that involved kind of going through the same work that I'm asking my clients to do, working through shame messaging, you know, whether it's through media or colleagues or family, friends, just if there was anything that said, Sarah, don't do something, don't go there, don't own this or celebrate this. Like, I had to challenge it and jackhammer it, and so to speak, say, no, this is me and this is who I am and this is how I practice. And interesting enough, what would happen is the minute I started doing that and practicing it on the regular, my therapy was getting better too. Because now it's not just Sarah doing something out of a book, right? Or something Sarah's trained to do. It's like, no, Sarah's doing great therapy because Sarah's a great therapist, because of all the unique aspects that I bring to the table and then apply the skills that I've learned through the years. So it's that combination of both, that I can't just, you know, be a perfect therapist just because I graduated graduate school or because I got straight A's. Like, I'm a great therapist because who I am as a human and how that highlights and showcases what I learned. So that's what I would say is my unique challenge and how I
That's a very unique challenge, and I'm glad like you've overcome it and still working with it, because that's, you know, something I think that other graduate students may also feel, is like, I'm doing all this work, but like, how can I be like my best self? How can I help myself? So I think that's a huge message for like students that are pursuing the career, where they can go, and hearing that from you is really powerful. So thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. I know you just changed roles. You just started this new role in July. Is there something that you're doing in particular with your new career, or not new career, new place of work or within KPA that you're super excited about with psychology?
I think that it might sound simple, but like, I'm just excited to know what private practice is about, because I've only been in the world of nonprofit, you know, so to kind of expand the kind of the vision that, like, you know, there's tons of people out there in the world, and the majority of the folks that I've served are marginalized, oppressed, low income, difficult family circumstances. You know, many couldn't afford their own health insurance, you know, so they're on Medicaid. And then especially in designated rape crisis center services, those services are free, you know, and so, you know, having that as a foundation to my career really set the tone for, like, everybody has intersecting identities. Everyone goes through hardships and experiences that are unfathomable to think of. And so now to completely shift gears into private practice, where it's like, okay, you know, these folks are going to be completely different. And yet I think I kept telling myself, like, my brain in a limited box of like people with privilege or people with less hardships would have less than quote unquote mental health issues. And it's like, no, that's not the case. I've started working with a couple of clients, and I'm like, oh, these mental health symptoms are just as severe, just as valid, just as complicated. It's just in a completely different, you know, just a different world. And so I think that's just kind of where it's helping me to be that ongoing learner of, like, you know, there's many people out there in different contexts. And so while I've done a lot of that kind of like on the front lines kind of work for so long, that there's still many people beyond those front, you know, initial front lines that need help as well. So I think that's exciting to kind of see how far my service can reach and beyond.
Yeah, no, that's super exciting. What do you, so you, now you're in private practice. So what do you like most about being in private practice?
Well, what really prompted the transition was just needing a complete change. I had been doing nonprofit work for so long that, you know, I wanted to utilize the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. Those things got approved, they're done. So when I was thinking about like, okay, what do I want to do? Do I want to work for another agency? Do I want to do my own thing? And it really just kind of came down to, I really needed more flexibility in my life versus like that 9 to 5, 40 hour, you must be here. I really needed more flexibility because I added a kiddo in April of last year. So I'm a, you know, mom of two. So when I'm thinking about what would I want me and my husband and our two kids to get to experience, and it's like, well, we'll get to experience a lot more if I'm not bootstrapped to the 40 hour job all the time. So flexibility was a big key factor. And then I also wanted to join a group practice because I did not feel ready to kind of wing it on my own, like navigating, you know, rent and overhead expenses, finding an office. Am I going to be an LLC or a PLLC? Like, I don't know, like this is not my lane. So that's why it kind of attracted me to True North, because that way I'm joining a group and that group is going to help figure out a lot of those things on my behalf. And then I just get to see clients, you know, I get to do it when I'm best at. I'm not a business person per se. So getting able to just do therapy, do my documentation, do my best work while Janelle gets to kind of take care of the business aspect of it. I really like that. On top of just also feeling supported. Because again, if it were me by myself kind of winging it, you know, I would get that pressure to kind of do it on my own, you know, or kind of like go rogue, even though I know there are colleagues in the field who would have helped me. Getting more of that constant staff interaction and stuff kind of helped fulfills what I also loved about working at an agency, is because I would always get to talk to people. Versus just me being solo. So great staff support. And also I don't have to take care of the business aspects of it. Helped me really, really like where I'm at now.
That sounds like a huge win for you. We're very excited about that. Who are some prime influences, whether it was a professor or a family member or a colleague, that helped shape you to where you are today?
So I got a lot. So this one, it's like, I felt like I wrote like a novel, but I'm going to try and like not stick a novel about it. Because when I saw this question, I'm like, there's just so many people. And like, I won't be able to name them all, but there's many. But I think on a pure foundational level, and people aside, people are great. But I wouldn't be where I am without my spiritual beliefs. You know, my husband, we both were raised in the church. And our faith kind of evolved, you know, through the years. But if I didn't have that, like, I don't think I'd be where I'm at, because it's those principles of grace and forgiveness and, you know, love thy neighbor. I mean, it's just those foundational things about what it means for me to be, you know, a Christian believer. I mean, I can't remove that part of myself. Like, I just can't. But having that, it solidified my own values of grace, of kindness, genuineness, and forgiveness. And it just kind of put a fire in me too, that there's many people in the world, whether they believe what I believe or not, that they deserve grace. They deserve mercy. They deserve justice. They deserve all the things, on at least on a foundational principle of what I believe in. And so if I could be at least one person who could be be the best human being I possibly can be, then that's important to me. You know, of course, you know, doing the witnessing and all that stuff is important too. But at the end of the day, for me, showing people love, showing people grace, showing people kindness, is just who I am. That's just kind of, those are my biggest life priorities. Then when you add people into the mix, then I'm going to go on like on a big, I feel like I'm going to go on a big tangent about how much I have loved the professors, both at Georgetown College and at Murray State University. I'm going to shout them out by name, but Dr. Jennifer Price, Dr. Karen McKenzie, Dr. Jay Castaneda, Dr. Susan Bell at Georgetown College, and there's more. but those that I've named, I mean, those folks treated me like they knew me, that they valued me, and that if I go to homecoming, they still know me and ask about my kids. Like, you just, that kind of bond just isn't present everywhere. It just isn't. I'm not a number to them. They cared about me so much to make sure that I succeeded and learned the material. And anytime I needed help, that they were there, they helped guide me and, you know, navigate different career path decisions. So I can't say enough great things about them. And Dr. Karen McKenzie in particular, like while she was in social psychology, I mean, I remember taking psychology and law as one of my electives. And after that exam, she asked me, she's like, oh, how do you think you did? And I was like, I don't know. I think I failed. She goes, no, I think you did great. I think you did fine. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I was completely bummed out. I left, day goes by. She sends me an email sometime later that day. And she goes, Sarah, I just had to let you know that I kept thinking Sarah's going to get an A on this exam. Sarah's going to get an A on this exam. And so I graded your exam and you got an A plus a couple bonus points. And I was like, what professor does that? Like, that they kind of took the special time, you know, she could have been grading other exams, but she took the time to email me just to say, I had that faith in you and I knew you could do it and you did it. And I just had to let you know. I'm like, like, wow. Like, this is amazing. Like, Karen's a great human. And I love seeing her in the community because I live in Georgetown. So occasionally I'll see her at Kroger or something like that. And I mean, it just touches me every, you know, my heart every time. And the same goes for the professors at Murray State, Dr. Laura Lilliquist, Dr. Angie Trespass, Dr. Dan Juan. Again, these were all folks that they cared about me so much, so as students, that they wanted me to succeed. And they did whatever they had to help me succeed in whatever way that looked like. So those people are amazing. other influences, I can't, again, say enough great things about my past clinical supervisors. I had Dr. Shirley Settle, Dr. Pat Burke, Dr. Erica Priestess, and Dr. Ellen Crawford. All of those humans, again, helped mold and shape what kind of therapist I am today, because each one of them had a different clinical style, had a different approach, perspective. And so it really helped broaden my repertoire and my perspective and views on case conceptualization and making sure I'm looking at clients in different lenses, kind of in ways that I would kind of always be, you know, to the manual, you know, as a client, strictly the DSM criteria or something like that. And it's like, no, but look at it this way and look at it this way and look at it this way and see how that, even if it's not strictly the bullet points that you see in a manual or some standardized therapy modality, that these people are going through really hard things and that these hard things can be representations of these symptoms. So not every client's going to be cookie cutter, you know, into the book. So how about you think about this and look about this? And then I think later on, as I started doing sexual violence work, I'm going to shout out Leanne Hazlett, even though she's probably covering her face right now if she heard this. Leanne was my former administrative supervisor where I worked before, and she taught me how to be a firm advocate. You know, I'm usually introverted. I'm usually not one to like cause a fuss. You know, like I just kind of like stay quiet and kind of ignore things. And it's like, well, it's not my problem, you know, and you keep your blinders on. And so when she started saying, you know, once you see rape culture, once you see oppression, once you start seeing a lot of these things, you can't unsee it. Like, you can't just keep your blinders on. I mean, I guess you could choose to, but it would be with the acknowledgement of what really painful things are you ignoring in other people's hurt and other people's hardships. And it's like, well, I don't want to do that. So as the more I've had to start looking and observing and actually speaking up and being like, that's horrible. This is ridiculous. Like, why is there a ton of anti-LGBTQ legislation? Why is there, you know, racial injustice? What, you know, when you start seeing it so much, it's like, no, I can't shut up about it anymore. So learning how to be a firm advocate came from Leanne, because without that, I probably still would just be kind of silent and kind of in my own little bubble. And so with her and the help of other staff over the years where I worked previously, it helped me learn how to not be afraid to use my voice to help others in need, whether in small ways or big ways. So I'd say all of that combined kind of made a positive impact on me as a human and professional.
That's awesome. Even that your list was, felt like it was long. I think you touched everyone. And I think that goes huge, speaks huge volume for professors that may be listening, that like your impact makes a huge difference on your students and look at where they are now, because they wouldn't have been there without them. So thank you for sharing those names. I hope they listen and I hope they hear what an impact they made on your life to make you the therapist that you are today. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your life away from work. Like what hobbies do you do? You know, do you go any vacations? What do you and your family like to do? What do you like to do?
So I am married to my husband, Tyler. And so we've been married for 12 years, but we've been together for 18. It's kind of a cute romantic comedy kind of story, but like we met at Georgetown College. I met him at a pledge party. I had rushed a sorority the week before, and then he had rushed a fraternity the week after. So then the fraternities were hosting their little pledge parties, and meeting him was kind of like on a whim because I had no plans or intentions of meeting anybody. And so it was a sorority sister, just like, hey, come dance with him. And he was kind of like standing by a pole, kind of that wallflower look. And I was like, okay. And then sure enough, asked me for my number. And we later discovered like we have never dated anyone else, you know, before that moment. So to marry and only date the only person you've ever really had a serious relationship with, I mean, that's just, it's cute. So we've been together for a long time. And so together we have two kiddos. Jacob will be 7 this year. And Anna was born in April of last year. So she's currently about 15 months. And I'd say just, I mean, me as an individual, like I love listening to music. That's been my primary coping skill since I was a teenager. Because just my motto is, if you got a problem, there's a song about it. In whatever genre that you love. So if you're angry, there's an angry song about that somewhere. If you're depressed, there's a depressed song about that somewhere. You know, so I love music, and I tend to lean, and some people might guess it, some people don't, but I tend to lean on the kind of alternative metal rock side of things, which kind of surprises some people, because, you know, maybe I just don't have that physical outlook of like, I listen to rock. Yeah. Like, you know, most people guess like country, you know, or Christian music or something. It's like, nope, I listen to some heavy metal on occasion. But I think as a family, we've been bonding lately over Star Wars. My son's getting really into it. He loves Darth Vader and Kylo Ren, even though he has the heart of a Jedi. He's like, I still love Kylo Ren and Darth Vader, and he loves his lightsabers and cannot wait to watch the movies. So that kind of warms me and my husband's hearts, because that was one of our first dates after we met, was watching Attack of the Clones, one of the prequels. So it's like, oh, we have like a family of Star Wars. And today I think we're kind of planning what we're going to be for Halloween. And so Jacob's like, I'm going to be Kylo Ren. I'm like, okay, well, should Anna be Grogu from Mandalorian, or should she be Rey? you know, from the sequels. And he thinks, I think she could be Rey. And I was like, okay. And I said, I'll probably be Princess Leia then. And then, you know, dad can be, you know, Darth Vader or something. So we love bonding over Star Wars. But if we're not doing that, you could usually find us either eating at local restaurants, cheering on UK sports. We haven't had too much luxury to travel because I think just financially we've kind of had different milestones in life. So when my husband and I first started living on our own after we got married, it's like we were check to check for a while. We didn't have the luxury of travel. And then it's like, okay, we'll get a house. We'll have more income. And it's like, okay, we've cushioned the savings. We could buy our own house. We can get our own car. Okay. And then, okay, kids, then diapers, you know, and formula, that kind of sucks up a lot of the costs. So it's like, okay, you know what? By golly, I want to go on a vacation, like a real vacation where no other family's around or paid for it. Like, I just want to do it. So my husband and I went to Clearwater for our 10-year anniversary. And that was like our first full week beach vacation that wasn't like paid for or, you know, an accompaniment for other people with other people. So that felt super awesome. And then fall break of last year, we were able to do a mini family vacation to Columbus, kind of in part for my son's 6th birthday. He wanted to go to Legoland up there. So I was like, okay, family vacation, mini, you know, Columbus. Well, then this past year, kind of the end of Memorial Day, we were able to go to Asheville for about a week. So I was like, okay, we're finally getting into this spot where we can start to travel. So that's what I'd like to do more as a family, like even if it's not frequently, but even just one a year would just be great. Cause I love seeing different parts of the world. I love exploring, I love water. So I hope that as a family, we can do that more. It's like, I have big pipe dreams. It's like, okay, we're finally gonna do Disney, you know, right? Cause I haven't been to Disney since I was like 5. I was like, okay, we'll finally go to Disney. And then we can go to, you know, Galaxy's Edge, you know, like we can finally do the things. And then also have a pipe dream of going to Universal so I can go to the Wizarding, you know, World of Harry Potter. Like, I want to do that too. So I got big, big dreams to travel. But yeah, we're kind of a chill family. Like, if we're not really doing things, we're usually just like at home. We're either homebodies or we're traveling.
There's nothing wrong with being a homebody. I can't say that enough for me and my family as well. You said Harry Potter World. So what's your house?
See, I can't really commit fully to a house because I feel like I'm just a hybrid of many different things. Okay. So the house I would want to be in would be Ravenclaw. Like, I love the vibe of Ravenclaw. I love the bird theme. I love the colors. Like, I love like academics and being like really wise. Like, I get it, but my whole personality is Hufflepuff. Like, I am just like a Hufflepuff friendly person. So I'm just like, okay, I have the brain of a Ravenclaw, but the personality of a Hufflepuff. So I'm kind of like a hybrid. So I don't know. I would assume if the sorting hat were on my head, it would say Hufflepuff, but I'm like, I kind of want to be a Ravenclaw too.
Well, if you think it, it can pick it. I remember that. Do you, besides your therapy work, is there any, like, do you do any research? Is there something like that you're like constantly like learning about in your field that you are staying up to date on?
In terms of my own research projects, not so much. I think that was probably my least favorite thing in graduate school, is like stats and research and like doing my, you know, thesis. Like, well, my thesis was interesting in the topic, but to do the legwork of it, I was like, I just really want the results already. So I think that's also kind of helped me like steer clear of getting my doctorate, because I think I had a dream. It's like, you know, one day I'll get my doctorate to do research. But then I'm like, do I want to write a paper right now? No. Like, I have no desires to write papers or stats. Like, let me just help clients. Like, that's what I want to do. But what I enjoy learning about, and so learning from other folks' research, I mean, I have loved Brené Brown. because I mean, I was reading Rising Strong, reading, I thought it was just me, reading Gifts of Imperfection, learning through all of those books. I'm like, you know, those books really helped me a lot. And so I know when she does a lot of research on shame and vulnerability, I'm like, these were the things that I know I personally struggled with. So like, if I could read and learn more about how to help folks get into the muck of those processes, like, I love it. And I know Brené Brown's just one of probably many, but I love work, love reading Brené Brown's, you know, research on shame and vulnerability. And I've more recently loved the work by Dr. Mark Brackett, and he's a psychologist at Yale, studying emotional intelligence. And so it's like, oh, okay, how do we, you know, explore our feelings, identify our feelings, regulate those feelings, and also do that with safe spaces? Because by reading that book, Permission to Feel, it really kind of helped broaden my gaze a lot, because I think I would help clients with feelings, but there were even some processes as I was doing that, that Mark's work helped illustrate how we could do that better. So like, I was using the term regulate for the longest time, like, I'm going to help a client regulate their emotions. But did I really know and understand what regulate meant? And so when there's a whole chapter in his book, Permission to Feel, on, you know, the last ruler skill, regulate, and I'm like, oh, this is what regulate means. This is how, and, you know, what processes a person is going to do in order for an emotion to regulate. And, you know, there's different facets of it and processes of it. And so I'm like, oh, okay. So I was using this term, thinking it a particular way, and it wasn't. Or my version of it, or my perception of it at the time, was just one small facet. So I love Brené Brown, love Mark Brackett's work, because learning from them helps inform and help me be better as a therapist overall.
So watch Sarah and I try pushing KPA to get Brené Brown here one day.
Oh, yeah.
We'll see. Are there still goals that you hope to accomplish in your career?
The one that keeps sticking out to me is learning how to, like, I know I talked earlier about finding that internal sense of confidence. It's like, okay, now I have that. It's like, I know my stuff. I know I'm good. I'm still going to be learning, and, you know, I'm never going to, you know, hopefully plateau, but there was still this little piece of me that's just like, well, you're not good enough to host a webinar or a training. Or how about Sarah comes in and teaches this other group of, you know, therapists about a particular topic? Then all my shame bells start going off, and I'm like, Sarah can't do that. Sarah's not the expert in that. You need this person. You need this person. You need this person. So I think that's what I would like to see myself in the, you know, when I look at how my career can continue to unfold. It's like, okay, now you've owned your stuff, Sarah. Now share it with the world, you know, or even at KPA or at KPA convention, like host a webinar or a lunch and learn series. I'm like, but there's other people that are smarter than me. No, you're smart enough. You can do the thing. So I think it's developing that. And I think KPA, by being on the board, has kind of helped a little bit too, because it's like, oh, I do have expertise to share. Right now I'm just sharing it on a board of director level, but on a clinical expertise level, there's that too. So I think I'm still kind of striving towards that. I may not be ready by this year's convention, but maybe by next year, that might be a possibility at some point.
We will have a space for you on the calendar whenever you want it. Whenever you're ready, we'll be there for you. What is one way that psychologists are or can make the world a better place?
I honestly, right now, I mean, it's going to sound really simple, but I think psychologists can make the world a better place by just being good humans. I mean, we're seeing day in and day out, just how polarized folks can be on any given issue. You know, so it's, I could just see our country right now just shifting into, it's like, it's black or it's white. It's all or it's nothing. For it, against it. You know, you're good guy or bad guy. You're with us or you're my enemy. And it's like, psychologists need to not entertain that polarization. Like, they might internally have their own views or opinions on some of those topics, but the at the end of the day, we're in a field of helping and serving others. And so while we are already kind of aware of like how to be cognizant of our own bias and prejudice, and so how that doesn't inform or impact our work with someone, at the end of the day, we need to be good humans. The world needs more folks to be less polarized and kind of in this all or nothing culture that's like, no, regardless of who you are, whatever identity you are, if I am competent and capable of practicing and serving you, then I'm going to do so the best of my ability. Just so, again, everyone in our Commonwealth or in the world potentially can feel like, okay, when the whole world kind of seems against me, there's at least one person who gives a damn, right? And so if that's a therapist, cool. If that's a coach, cool. If that's a family member, amazing. But everybody needs at least one person, because as we start getting into these like polarizing, you know, cultures and vibes of things, then it's just easy to get into this love and hate. Or for folks to feel ashamed and to kind of hide or pick sides. And it's, you know, sometimes we just need to kind of embrace ourselves as who we are fully. And that might not pick a side, and that might be somewhere in the middle. And that's just kind of how I operate as a human. Like, I'm very rarely an all or nothing extreme kind of person. I kind of always hover in the middle of like, why can't we meet in the middle? And it's just, the world's just not liking that. It's just like, no, you need to pick a side. And it's like, no, like, we as psychologists know that like ultimatums are terrible. So we don't need to treat people that way. We don't need to treat other humans in ultimatums. So be good humans. And making sure that we don't let the polarization of the world restrict our work and the impact that we can do.
Something so simple, but so powerful. So I appreciate you sharing that. We have about two more questions. One you don't know about, one I'm going to ask you now. What is your best advice for those just beginning or starting to pursue their career in psychology?
I would say, don't worry about being an expert or finding your niche immediately. Because, I mean, again, psychology didn't find me naturally, you know, it's kind of like a spur of the moment decision. But even afterward, and I went to graduate school, I was on this high horse of like, I'm going to be a kid and adolescent therapist. I love kids. I love teens. And I found like, once I started doing it in community mental health, the kids are great. The clients were great. Families were great. But I found that there was just a lot of things that even if I understood it, and even though I valued its importance, the application, the follow through of it just wasn't clicking for me for whatever reason. A lot of the building a community of support, making sure the schools were happy, making sure case managers were happy, making sure the parents were happy, the kids were happy, resource coordinators at the, you know, the FRISC coordinators, like, it's like, okay, I'm trying to manage a bunch of different folks and they all have different needs. And I know it's to all serve these kiddos, and that's super important. Why is this not clicking for me? So I knew it was important, but then they're like, you need to do it. You need to do it. And I was like, I know I need to do it, but I don't know how, or I'm trying to do it and it's going horrible. So eventually, about halfway through my community health career, you know, an administrative decision was made. It's just like, you know, how about we let another person be the kid person, and we're going to give you more adults. I was like, okay, this is not really what I wanted, but okay. And so I saw more adults, and I started noticing that the adults who are disempowered had trauma experiences, and a lot of the cases were women. I was like, why are these clients thriving more, healing more? Why are my approaches more successful? I'm having a better keep rate, all these other things. And it's like, oh, this is probably my lane. This is probably what I'm the best at. And then towards the end of Community Health, seeing a position open at a designated right crisis center, I was like, you know what? I think this is my lane. And then once I got into that field where all of the clients were sexual violence survivors and disempowered or marginalized individuals, I'm like, oh yeah, this is my lane. This is what I want to do. So I would encourage the prospective graduate students of like, be willing and flexible with respect to finding your niche or expertise, because you just never know. What you think you might be a natural at may not be the case down the road, or it might be, but either way, be flexible. So just kind of learn how to adapt your practice over time, because you never know. You know, your best successes with clients could be with a population that you didn't expect initially. So be flexible, have wiggle.
That's really good advice. Everyone listening, take that advice. All right, last question before we end this episode. Didn't put it on here, but I ask every podcast guest, if you were to be prompted to go sing karaoke right now, what would be your go-to song?
Man, karaoke song, dude, I might have to get out my iPod stuff. I think, I'm sure if I went and saw my playlist, I'm gonna see what are my most played, 25 most played songs, and we'll see which ones I have sung out the most. This is the thing. I probably won't be able to pick just one.
Give us a whole show.
Well, let's see. The two are on here for Paramore. So I probably sing The Only Exception and I Caught Myself, because I also liked Twilight. So I Caught Myself from their Twilight. And The Only Exception. Those would be two that I would probably sing quite a bit. It's like, I love Hayley Williams' voice. It's like, I probably won't do it justice, but I would probably sing one of those two.
Paramore is such a great choice, so I'm glad you said that. All right. Well, thank you for joining us today on this episode. We really appreciate your insight, your advice, everything you shared with us that's brought you into your career with psychology. So I hope you all enjoy this episode and stay tuned for future episodes.
Thank you.